Hello, everybody, and welcome to Cloud 259 Running on Air. I'm Greg Lemostein, and as always, I'm with my co-host, Bren Jones. This is episode 94, and it's Saturday, December 21st, the winter solstice here in the Northern Hemisphere, at least, which means the days are going to get longer starting now.
I like it. Well, happy holidays, Greg. Happy holidays to all our listeners, and it's a very happy day for me because I'm not working next week. Woohoo! I was thinking, Greg, one of the best things about having an office job, maybe the best thing about having an office job, is that you get vacation and you get paid when you're on vacation. So thank you, offices around the world. So we're going to talk more about outdoors tonight than indoors, though. Rather than talk about being trapped in our cubies, we're going to talk about running in the fields of Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, Greg. We did a little bit of cross country, and not only did we do a little cross country, but you caught up to the coach of the team that had just an incredible performance on the men's side in the open 10K. So we've had this gentleman on the show before. I think he's kind of like one of these mad scientists, very brilliant, very focused, and intense coaches. So Greg, who was it that you caught up with?
It was Tom Tin Man Schwartz, who we've had on before, and he's always interesting to listen to. And he's perfect. I mean, his team does so well on any surface, but it seems like they're so well suited to cross because they're a real team. And that's one of the things that we enjoyed about our experience, and we'll talk about that after the interview. But it's a real team event, cross country, especially club champs. But it's also a road trip for us. We left the city and got out in the green of Pennsylvania. Everybody will tell you, you have to do cross country. Some will say it's good for building strength for whatever your events are later in the year. And I think that's true. It's also just a lot of fun, just tons of fun to run in the mud for a while.
And muddy it was. So we'll just talk briefly, Greg, before we play the tape on the Schwartz interview. I just want to talk briefly about one impression I had from the women's race. We were there, Greg and I ran in the 40-59 race, which had hundreds of competitors, over 400 competitors. But there were several races during the day, and one of them was the Open Women's 6K. And again, this was Club Cross Country Nationals, USATF Club Cross Country Nationals. And Greg, watching that race was really fun. Watching all the races was fun. It was so impressive to see the front of the field. And the woman who ended up finishing second has certainly gotten a lot of headlines, Caitlin Toohey, because of her success as a high school runner. And she's very young and very good. I would say, though, looking at the entire front of that field, Greg, they're just the strength was really impressive. The other visual that struck me was watching the open men's race when you could see from afar sort of the train of runners running along. It was so impressive, just so fast to see in person how fast these people are running over the fields. Something about it was more impressive than watching them on a track or seeing a marathon. Just a great day to be out there. It's such impressive performances, and we'll talk about sort of our personal experiences of the races too. But why don't we get to your interview, Greg? The Tin Men certainly dominated the men's race. You talk a little bit about it with the coach. So let's hear what he had to say.
So we're very excited to have back on our show Coach Tom Tin Man Schwartz, who tells me he's nearly lost his voice screaming for his Tin Men a few days ago to a third straight club cross championship. Coach Schwartz, welcome back to Cloud 259 and congrats on another win.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Coach, before I get to the race itself, I have one overarching question, which is what makes a great cross-country runner? I'm not very good at it, so I think that's why I'm fascinated by it. We know that training for the event is one thing, but if you had, let's say, a bunch of runners who are all equal in a flat 5K or 10K, how would you pick out the stellar cross-country runner? Because it seems like some people are just plain better at it.
Well, there are physiological and psychological components that are required to compete successfully in cross-country. From a physiological point of view, you have to have extraordinary stamina. And if I had, let's say I have three guys and they could run 13:45 for 5K, which is not too uncommon for my team, I could tell you who will likely run better in cross-country physiologically based upon their stamina or their endurance index. So if I were to compare their performances over 5 kilometers and the 1500 meters, or 5 kilometers and 800 meters, whoever slows down the least will likely, from the 5K to the 15 or the 15 to the 5K, that differential, if it were smaller, that predicts they will run well in cross country over 10 kilometers versus the one that has a huge differential. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's the physiological component. In terms of psychological, it's somebody who absolutely has a passion for cross country, of course. That definitely is a positive. Somebody who has an ability to run on varying terrain, mm-hmm, certainly has definitely an advantage. And to some degree, that's a trained situation. You develop skills, physiological, biomechanical skills as you practice running on undulating terrain. Uh-huh. So running on flat surfaces like pavement or the track is a skill that is not necessarily transferable to cross-country irregular terrain. Mm-hmm. So you certainly want to practice on uneven surfaces, hills, curves, if you knew ahead of time it was going to be rainy, soft, muddy, you probably should practice on that at least a couple times a week for 3 or 4 weeks. We didn't anticipate that. My team didn't. But we did run on grass a few times and run on dirt several times. Uh-huh. And that's something we do regularly because I'm a big believer in it. Mm-hmm. And I think that helps them quite a bit when they get to the club cross country because they're used to the feel of the undulating terrain, the irregular surface. And what I mean by irregular surface is, you know, think about running on pavement or on track where you land your foot on the surface and it's smooth. Mm-hmm. Where the grass could have a lump on one part of, you know, part of the grass, and so your foot, maybe your big toe lands on a lump, and the outside of your foot lands substantially farther down, mm-hmm, you know, at an angle, you know, 15 degrees or something. That irregular terrain, the regular surface, is somewhat difficult to navigate when you're not accustomed to it.
You know, I asked the same question of my coach, Nate Jenkins. And he said exactly the same, two of exactly the same things that you said. He said mentally, a good cross-country runner is a racer, doesn't get thrown off by splits. He also talked about the form works in bad footing, and that's partially learned, but mm-hmm, you just have to be used to that. I'm not. But he also said that the best cross-country runners are strong, like farmhand strong, like better at deadlifts and squats. And I wonder, turning to your team, Morgan Pearson, the big winner, is a triathlete. I wonder if he fits into that overall just strong category.
Well, I might say it somewhat differently, but it certainly supports Coach Jenkins' philosophy there. I would say that you are strong for your body size. Mm-hmm. So I come from a farming background, and I think of it a little bit differently. Farm strong means you can lift heavy objects. Well, I don't really think that's the case for being a successful cross-country runner. You're strong for your body weight. Mm-hmm. right? Powerful. You know, think of a lot of traditional of the Africans, whether Ethiopian or Kenyans, that have been superstars in cross country. The vast majority of them have been very lightweight and have no upper body strength at all to speak of.
Right.
They quite literally can't lift more than 100 pounds over their head. You know, Arthur Liddy used to talk about it, and he would point out that the Americans were messing everything up and trying to lift a lot of heavy weights for their upper body. And look, you know, he would point out, for example, at the Prefontaine meet, hey, look, that African who has pencil arms is kicking the crap out of the American who has big buff arms. Mm-hmm. So my point is, you got to be strong for your body size, but not necessarily able to lift a lot of absolute weight.
But what about squats and deadlifts, that sort of thing?
I could care less about them.
Really?
Yeah. What transfer is there? You're talking, running is very specific. And at the elite level, even more specific. When I always tell the story at clinics, you know, two brothers show up, they're twin brothers. They're sedentary. They haven't done any athletic conditioning in their entire life. They're couch potatoes. On day one, we test them on the track. They run four laps. They both run 8 minutes. Then we differentiate their training during the subsequent month. One runs four or five times a week and builds up from 10 or 15 minutes up to 30 minutes by the end of the month. All comfortable, probably 75% heart rate or something to that effect, whatever metric you want to use. The other kid goes in the weight room three times a week under a strength training coach's guidance, does proper lifts like or typical lift like deadlift and squats or whatever. At the end of the month, we retest them. The one who ran multiple times per week runs a 7:30. The other one runs a 7:40. And then we justify strength training and say, look, strength training is so great for you. He blew 20 seconds and he didn't even run. But really, why did he improve 20 seconds? Was it directly related to his increase in his squat power or his deadlift power? Or was it a small amount due to that? And more due to the fact that now he has anabolic hormones in his body because he's actually exercising for the first time. His body gets leaner and stronger. Now, if you do it for a second month, where the second month the first boy continues to run, maybe increases it a little bit, and retests at the end of the month, he ends up running a 7:10. The other kid who weight trained, he runs a 7:35. He only improved 5 seconds. And you go to the third month, and now they're down. It still runs. It's like 7:32 for the kid who weight trains. It diminishes over time. Because at that point, you know, he's active versus he was sedentary before. And you can extrapolate this principle. You could say the person who is a novice runner, who doesn't really run that much volume or intensity, they're running 20 or 30 miles a week, they're going to benefit greatly from strength training. Mm-hmm. Because it's just more activity. If they continue to run 25 miles a week like they did before, but now they're lifting three times 1 hour per week, that's more physical activity than they were doing before. And they're going to improve. At the high levels, like my athletes, right? They strength train not for necessarily to increase the power in their stride so much as to reduce the breakdowns, the injury rates, right? That's mm-hmm. the bigger goal. Mm-hmm. Make sure your body isn't falling apart when it's out there running 80 or 90 miles a week. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
Okay.
Would you prefer short, very steep hill running over squats and lunges? Maybe for
no, the squats and lunges are fine when you're average everyday Joe, but I don't want my guys doing hardly any of that. And Coach Lee, who's my strength training coach, and I have this conversation often. We're on the exact same page. Uh-huh. He tries to make all of the strength training very specific to running. Yep. We don't care if they squat 300 or 400 pounds. It's not going to transfer. Physiologists have known this for like five decades. It's called specificity, or the SED principle, specific adaptation to imposed demands. Mm-hmm. Right? And the more fit you are, the more specific it has to be.
Right.
Let's think of it this way. We test 100 elite runners, you know, in January for their squats. Okay? And come June, prior to the trials, we test them all again. Do you think from their squat numbers pre and post intervention, whether they did it or didn't do it during that 6 months, we could predict who will make the Olympic team? I say no, not at all.
Right, right.
Absolutely zero correlation.
Gotcha. Right? Yeah.
But I will tell you this, the guys that have been least injured and had the most, the greatest number of weeks of successful training, regardless of your training methodology, you're going to have the best chance of placing high at the Olympic trials. Because the truth is, the guys at that level, they're almost all super talented. So the differentiation is being injury free, training week after week using good training methods. There are lots of good training methods. And then having the psychological, mindset going into it to compete and adjust to the circumstances. Because in the trials, you don't have pacers. In the trials, you have to actually be a competitor and have to be race savvy. You have to have strategies. You have to be adjustable. You have to put yourself in the right positions. You have to know what moves count and what don't. You have to get yourself, if you have multiple rounds, you have to get yourself to the finals in good stead. You have to adjust to the weather. You have to adjust to sleeping environment, you name it. So that's why experience as a runner is really a big deal, meaning competitive experience. If you get out there competing and build up competitions prior to the Olympic trials, and the challenges you faced are widespread instead of just a narrow band, odds are you're going to have that repertoire, so to speak, to call upon in the finals of the Olympic trials. If you have great health, no injuries, several weeks of great training, and hopefully it's optimal training for you as an individual, then your chances are really good. You're going to compete well.
Well, that's a perfect segue to my next question, because there's also no pacers in club cross. And you talked about having a race plan and having experience. Brent and I were watching the race after our master's race had ended. We were about the 2K mark, and the leaders came through, and it was like a wall of camouflage singlets. The guys from the U.S. Army team, including Olympian steeplechaser Hillary Bohr were up front. Mm-hmm. Your guys were laying in wait. All of them except Morgan Pearson had been gapped. But then they fought back and just over, and then they took control basically in the second half. So Tell us about the race plan and how the guys executed.
Well, your observation is spot on. That was the plan. Other than Morgan and Aaron, who had, a good shot at winning it, in my view, going in. If they felt healthy and navigated the muddy terrain well, I thought they were pretty much unstoppable. And if they had run 12 kilometers instead of 10, they would have had a huge gap. I think the only one that was on par with them was Dylan Maggard. I had a nice long talk with him in the airport, and I am thrilled that he is back working with his coach at Utah State. I think his coach does a fantastic job, and he trains his athletes very similarly in philosophy and approach as me. So I have confidence that Dylan is going to continue to do well. But other than that, there are guys that just didn't have the overall blend of ingredients and strategy that they needed that day. The truth is, there is a difference between a flat course There's a difference between a course that's rolling hills, and there's a difference between a course that is wet versus dry. And you have to have strategies to maximize your physical abilities. But you really got to know what your fitness levels are, the various components of your fitness level going into the race, to form a good strategy. You might, if you were a coach and you had, five guys in front of you, it might be that two of the guys need to employ one strategy, and two of the guys need to employ a different strategy, and the fifth guy needs to employ an even different strategy. It largely depends upon their background, and then you have to know as a coach the psycho-emotive components. And I say psycho and emotive because they're both important. The psychological makeup, their tendencies, their mental problem-solving abilities, the psychological component. And then the emotive component, are they highly driven, passionate-wise? Are they more mellow, low-key? For example, when I talk with Dylan Maggard, I see a guy that's super mellow. That's his natural thing. He's even keel. He doesn't have extremes. At least that's my appearance of the few times that I've met him. He would have perhaps a different need from strategy-wise than somebody else who has similar physical fitness, but is more highly intense.
Does that mean Dylan can lay back a bit more, be more patient?
Yes. Yes, and I'm sure that's what his coach told him to do. You know, you can see he moved up steadily, 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 just like Aaron moved up, just like Reed and Brian Barraza kind of gradually moved up because they had more of a similar makeup. Morgan doesn't have quite the same makeup. Morgan is all fire and passion. He's Steve Prefontaine reincarnated. He is as fierce a competitor as you'll ever find. I've never personally met anybody more fierce than Morgan Pearson. He's the type of guy that were, out in the mountains and slipped down and got into a crevice, he would cut off his own arm to get out. He wouldn't even hesitate. He would go through that much pain if he had to.
Well, to run a 10K in that kind of wet, muddy course in sub 30 is just phenomenal. So he's a remarkable talent. But you had sort of worked with him and told him to stay up front and go for the win.
I basically told him not to go hammer and hard early. I said, don't hammer the first 3K. Traditionally, he has. In years past, he's gone right to the front and tried to hammer. And this year I told him, given the course conditions, I don't want you or anybody else to go fast the first 3 kilometers. I want you to wait till that fourth kilometer, which climbs. And I know my guys can handle hills as good as anybody. They are very well trained on hills. And they're psychologically confident and emotively confident going up hills. So on that fourth kilometer, that climb, which started right behind the starting line, that was their instruction, is to make a move on there. That's where you catch people and pull them away on both times going up that 1 kilometer hill.
It's kind of like a gradual, but sort of, long gradual hill. It's not very steep. There's a bit of a steep part just before it that takes your momentum away, but that's long, right, gradual hill just,
And we weren't afraid. We knew that we had phenomenal strength and stamina, so we were going to crush people on that. That was my belief. And the guys believe, what I tell them. I'm like, look, you're capable of crushing people on this hill. So just don't get in a panic. You wait till you get to that hill, because I don't think hardly anybody's going to touch you on that hill.
So that's where Aaron went into second place, right?
Aaron Templeton. Yeah. He got second. He moved strongly on the first time on the hill. And then on the second time up the hill, he really moved strongly. And he had to, because he needed to break, I think it was Hillary right behind him, was probably only at the bottom of that hill where the bridge was, coming up to the starting line the second time around as they climbed. Hillary was probably 3 or 4 steps behind Aaron. And by the time they got to the top, there was a big gap because Aaron just crushed him on that hill.
So let's talk about Aaron just for a second, because I only know of Aaron because of his big time move in the USATF 5K Champs, which was in New York, in the Big Apple, right before the New York Marathon. And Aaron came out of nowhere to catch the leaders late, then dropped the leaders, only to finish second behind Anthony Rotich, but ahead of some big stars like Eric Jenkins and Kip Churcher. So
that was 100% planned.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, strategy-wise, that was, he followed it to a T. The only thing I would say in retrospect is if he could waited maybe 100 meters more to do the final absolute all-out sprint. But the instruction was to hold back, to wait, to let those guys, you're going to go out too fast, because Aaron has phenomenal strength and stamina based on both his history at Furman and his development with the Tin Man Elite under my instruction. He is kind of upping his game at what he's good at. And he's good at holding a very fast, strong pace and gradually picking it up in the latter part of the race. When other people are tired, he can actually pick up the pace. And but he wouldn't be able to do that if he were trained with high-intensity speed training. He wouldn't be able to do that. He's trained with longer intervals and all the things that I do in mine to maximize his innate ability. And he's got the psychological profile and the emotive profile, the psycho-emotive profile, to be able to get revved up about really moving fast the latter part of the race. The second half of the race, he can accelerate. Morgan can do the same thing, too. Reed Fisher's just like that. They're sort of like they're sort of fired up, so to speak. You know what I'm saying? They're fired up about the second half of the race.
It's like a little bit more than just confidence. It's like audacity or maybe chutzpah or something like that. It's like, and not paying attention to what names are ahead of you. I don't think any of your guys care at all, like what people's pedigrees.
Well, that's what we talk about all the time. I constantly tell them, you can run at the front of the pack if you're running your pace. You don't run somebody else's race. I coach a bunch of elite high school runners, same thing. People there's so much misinformation about proper race strategy out there. And I see some really positive trends going on now. I see a lot of people starting to dial into just smarter racing, and blame it on old school guys like me and older than us who just were taught to get to the front and hammer as hard as we could. And that you can't possibly win unless you're in front. Or you can't possibly succeed, whether you win or second place or fourth place, unless you're at the front. You certainly can. Our school, my generation and older, we just didn't have it right. Because back then, the reason it succeeded by going to the front is that you were actually that fit. You were fit enough to hold on. The ones that won were doing big time mileage and had endurance enough to hold on versus their competitors who weren't doing as much mileage. And yeah, those guys could go out, felt comfortable in the first, third or half of the race, but because they weren't doing the mega distance running, they couldn't hold on. Was it the best possible strategy to maximize the performance of the person that was in the first, second, third position, just going to the front and hammering and holding on? No, but it worked. It worked because nobody else was doing the mega hard training, the mega volume training. But nowadays, people are training smarter than ever before. Lots of good coaches out there. Lots of good things happening to our sport. People are more well prepared. So it does come down to smarter tactics. You can't necessarily go to the front. Sometimes you go to the front and take people to the woodshed. Because they're dumb enough to be suckered into your strategy, that doesn't work very much anymore. There are too many guys out there well-trained. And if they're realizing, because of good examples that they see around them, that you can hold back and run a more steady pace and then pick off people who went out too fast.
So what would be a tip that you would give, on the mental side, assuming you've done the hard work, the training, the distance, should you try it? Like let the leaders go and just experiment with catching back up, or what kind of mental tip would you have for that?
I would say if you're not accustomed to that strategy, you don't want to wait until the championship event to apply it.
Right.
right? You want to practice in build-up competitions. In high school or college, you know, you have lots and lots of competitions prior to the end of the season, championship event. So you got plenty of opportunity to practice different strategies, and this may be one of them you want to practice, holding back. You may want to practice going to the front and going fast. If you see that the national championships or the state championships has a turn at 400 meters into the race and a left-hand or right-hand sharp turn, you may want to practice in your build-up competition going out fast to get out of the traffic. And then after you get around the curve for a little ways, then settling back into a more steady, even pace that you can sustain. So all those different all the different build-up competitions provide opportunity to practice strategies. You know, at the level of my 10-man elite and some of my other elites that are not on the team, you have experience. You've raced throughout high school and college for the most part, Drew Hunter being an exception, for example. And so you can call upon your past experience, but, you know, people race all the time and they don't learn from their mistakes. They just don't reflect. They have the same mantra. Well, I just got to go to the front. And I got to keep up with Joe or Larry or whoever's the big dude that I want to beat or whoever's a winner. I want to keep up with the winner. He's a proven winner. They don't learn from experience. So it is the case that you must make a concerted effort to evaluate each and every competition, every performance, and identify the strengths and weaknesses of your performance, as well as your how it played out against your competition. Mm-hmm. And always consider as you move forward your fitness level relative to where it was before. Because what may or may not have worked early in the season could be totally different in terms of the outcome at the end of the season because your fitness is different.
Absolutely. Sometimes we always train or race on the basis of our PR, but that might not be realistic in that moment, in that part of the year.
Yeah, you're cross country, and I think your coach, Coach Jenkins, is pointing out is that and when he's talking about competing, I think that's what you said, something that I've right. I absolutely agree with Coach Jenkins on this one. That course on Saturday was not about who has fast times or a certain pace. It was about competing and managing your energy, you know, wisely.
And that's really tricky unless you're doing it a fair amount on cross country. It's hard to know exactly where to be.
I'm not 100% sure. I fully agree with that. I partially agree with that concept. What I believe is, like, if you're experienced at running 10 kilometers, you know how you should feel on each mile, for example, or each kilometer, depending upon if you're an imperial metric person. But you know, in the first mile, if you're in a 10K, if you're breathing hard at the end of the first mile in a 10K, as if you're racing the 5K in the middle of a 5K, you're in trouble. It should feel too easy on the first mile. You know, and you know in a 10K that when you're in the fourth mile, it's going to start hurting pretty badly. But if you're already hurting in the, you know, the third mile as if it's the fourth, then you're going to have to back off. You got no choice. You got to back off and you're going to have to recover. You know, you kind of get messed up already. Right. So the important thing is to know thyself, you know, the William Shakespeare, know thyself and to thine own self be true. So in other words, focus on what you're capable of doing based on your knowledge and experience of yourself. And then that's why you have a good coach. If you get a good coach, he or she will say, look, this is your strength. You need to maximize your strength, mitigate your weaknesses, and execute this way, regardless of what everybody else is doing.
Right.
So if you focus on everybody else, you're going to be falling prey to their strategy.
Right. Coach, two more questions. You've been very generous with your time. Thank you so much. One is just the benefits of cross country to the runners going forward or to the team. It seems like it's tailor-made for your kind of close-knit 10-man group to go and do a cross-country event, because it builds character among the team, doesn't it?
It does. This begs the question, why don't we have more of these type events?
Yeah.
You go to Europe, you go to the UK, they got these kind of events all the time. Club competitions all over the place, all winter, cross-country. Mm-hmm. Why don't we have more of these in the United States? If I were in charge of USATF, I would say, look, let's strongly consider having more team events.
Yep.
Not only will it be exciting and exciting for our athletes, it'll be exciting for the sport. It'll grow the sport. Everybody relates to team. We're in the United States of America. We have big time team sports: football, yep, basketball, hockey, baseball, soccer, lacrosse. The average Gene and Joe public understands team. They don't understand individual sports unless they've done them. So we're doing ourselves a disservice by promoting our sport as an individual sport. I've said it for years. Every single big-time meet outside of the university or high school system should have relays. You go to the Prefontaine or you go to whatever big meet, they should have relays.
Yep.
Distance medley, 4x8, sprint medley, you name it.
Accidents.
Because people who don't know what good times are, they don't know what a good four-lap time is. Grandma and grandpa, aunt and uncle, the neighbor who are going there to support Sarah or Larry, right? They can understand when somebody says, there are four people on a team. They hold a baton. They run a lap. They hand off to the next person. Whichever team gets that baton around first for their four people, they win. Oh, I get it. They don't need to be told, oh, well, you know, the 351 to 353 for the, you know, is a good time and for the men. Or they don't need to know that. They just see the excitement of four people working together, running with a baton. They're not paying attention to the time. They're just watching this excitement. That's the kind of thing we need in America. That's one thing we need. IAAF should do.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. You're preaching to the choir, Coach.
Don't have enough time. We've got to scale it down to 90 minutes. So we're going to cut out the 5 and the 10K and blah, blah, blah. You know, no, I disagree. You can absolutely blow this up to 3 hours if you have various events and people will stay and you'll get sponsors. Right, you'll get sponsors. It'll pay for commercials on TV because it's exciting, and you got 25% of the public out there in Europe or in America. 25% increase in the viewership. You will easily sell our sport, sell commercial time.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, and I think your team bears that out. I think your team resonates with a lot of people. You got a lot of big fans. You have some people that choose to root against you for whatever reason, but it really adds to the sport. It adds spice to the mix. There's no doubt about it. My last question, Coach, looking ahead for the Tin Men into 2020, maybe focusing first on the marathon trials, who will be there representing the Tin Men in Atlanta?
There's 10 men and then there's 10 men coach, because I have several athletes that are at the trials that are not on the 10 men elite, by the way. Mm-hmm. So Reed Fisher is going to be running the trials in Atlanta on the 29th of February. He'll be running the Houston half marathon as prep. Mm-hmm. He hasn't run a marathon yet, but he qualified because he's run a 102 low. And so it'll be his first marathon. So that he's the only 10-man elite that I have running. I have other runners, several others, like Brogan Austin's a good example, and Evan Landis, and Austin O'Brien. And I have, I got Peter Falcon, who's on the bubble. I got, Johnny Rutford's going to be running. He ran 217. Who else we got? I'm trying to think. I got more. I got Lauren Weaver. I got probably one or two more that I can't think of. But my point is the trials are the Olympic trials marathon is it's a big tradition for America. Mm-hmm. Anybody who's in distance running recognizes it as a stellar event. It's worth watching. If you can be there, it's even better. It's going to be a multi-lap race course. I think they run 3 8-mile loops plus an extra. and it's going to be hard. It's going to be hilly and up and down. There's no flat sections on it at all.
Yeah. Well, I trust you'll be there on Leap Day in Atlanta. It'll be a big day for running and very exciting.
That's the plan. That's a plan. I'm sure the organizers there are going to do a great job. I think it's the Atlanta Track Club that's putting it on. So you pretty much can count on they know what they're doing. They run a lot of major road races like Peachtree and so on. And so they're known for their organizational skills, putting on a good event. So I'm confident that'll be the case. And it's going to be exciting on both sides, men and women. It's going to be super close, super difficult. It's going to be a race of attrition. I don't see very many people going out and then breaking everybody early and just holding on. I think there's just going to be packs that are just going to be dwindling with each lap. It'll get smaller and smaller and smaller. And finally, you got about five or six people in each race that are, you know, in for the top three slot. I think one or two people will break away, you know, 3-4 miles out from the finish, and then it'll be over.
On both the men's and women's side, you're saying?
Yeah. My one person for each, I believe, for both genders, will come from behind and get the third place. That's what I think.
Well, we just learned today that Des Linden is doing both the trials and Boston Marathon. And so she may strategically try to get third. We'll see. It'll be interesting. Just adds an interesting extra dimension to it.
Well, I think Des and her, you know, Des is for sure has the experience to be able to know how to do the buildups, the recovery post Boston, and how to build up again. And Des is a lightweight person. She's petite. And in my experience, people like that are resilient and bounce back from marathons much faster than people who are heavier.
Oh, good point.
More muscular, you know. Mm-hmm. So I would get bet anything that she'll be back to normal training by mid-May. Mm-hmm. You know, if she were to make the team, she would bounce back quickly.
Very good. Well, we can go on and on, Coach Schwartz, but thank you so much for your time and good luck. Happy holidays, happy new year, and we look forward to seeing you in Atlanta.
Same to you. Yes, I look forward to seeing you too. Take care now.
So, Greg, you mentioned during the interview how, you know, the Tin Men were chasing a few of the top Army guys there, including Laoi Lalang early in the race. But what were their finishing places exactly, their top five?
Yeah, I mean, they just obliterated the competition. The Army team actually didn't have five, mm-hmm. so they were not in the competition for the team race. But the Tin Men, Morgan finished first, Morgan Pearson, Aaron Templeton finished second. Brian Barraza finished sixth, Reed Fisher finished seventh, and Connor Winter finished ninth. So they had five guys in the top nine of the team competition. They had seven guys under 31:30 in a 10K on the mud. So that's just incredible.
I think Pearson's performance was it was sort of mind-boggling to me, because anyone out there will tell you how the conditions were rough. Like, basically, you were trying to find the green on the ground.
That's what I was doing. Yeah, exactly.
And it was sort of interesting because the center of the course, there were two white lines that you had to run between, and they're, I don't know, like 15 feet apart or something. So within those two white lines, you could run anywhere. But the middle of the course was completely muddy. So you'd have sort of two separate strands of runners at some point on the sort of hugging the edges of those lines. You know, you were just trying to find the best footing. I mean, basically the entire race, you were just hoping you wouldn't slip. And it's very challenging, very hard. But this guy, the top 10 man guy, he finished sub 30 and he looked very strong the whole time. And particularly when he finished, it looked like he could have kept going. I mean, it didn't seem like the course had taken it all out of him. And to think that he finished in, you know, 29 minutes something for a 10K. I mean, wow.
And he's a triathlete. Just incredible.
Yeah.
So what about our race, Bren? What was your experience like?
Okay, so we were running with the Central Park Track Club, of course. And Greg, I think your guys, your 50 and up, did better than our 40 and up.
I do have the stats here, Bren. So the Central Park men's 50 and over team finished eighth in the country. Mm-hmm. Your team, the 40, the youngins, the 40 and overs, finished 20th. Nothing to sneeze at. The open women for Central Park finished ninth, and the open men finished 26th. The masters women finished 12th, and the 60 and over men finished 18th. So Central Park brought a lot of runners. It was great fun having them all around. And I think we acquitted ourselves pretty well as a team. However, we were not that relevant in our team's results. We were both, I think we were both last in our age category for our teams.
Yeah. Okay. Now you're getting to the, okay. So I'll say the competition was fierce. All right. Yes. Central Park Track Club, even though we didn't have, you know, our A teams out there in the open races.
Yeah.
We didn't have the absolute best runners on their best days in their tip top form for this race. Mm-hmm. It's still a very strong track club. And we still had our sort of our wheels blown off on the men's side. I think our women did a bit better mm-hmm. in the open, I think. And, you know, Greg, we're not horrible runners. We tried pretty hard. But I was 299th out of 444. And Coach Chu, James Chu, who we've had on the show and who I shared a ride with on the way to the race, wanted to make sure that I mentioned this was Cloud 299. So something to be proud of. Cloud 299 out of 444. That's not even halfway up the field, Greg. I didn't know whether there were many people I had beaten. I was surprised. I was happy there was over 100 people I beat because I thought there was just about five of them. And I knew that one of them was you. So
I was 358. Yeah, Cloud 358 for me out of 444.
Yeah. And I mean, this includes quite a few guys who are older than us.
Yeah.
There a lot of runners older. Like the competition was pretty awesome.
That's the amazing thing about cross country in general, but club champs in particular. It's just an amazingly strong field. Maybe not even like it's not the best runners in the country. It's not the top pros. It's but just such depth of like great club runners and no slouches, just none. Mm-hmm. I guess if you're going to travel to Bethlehem, PA, and also if you're serious about cross country, they tend to be more often like really dedicated, good, talented runners.
Yeah. Well, it's fun. It's a real experience. And, you know, part of the meet or part of any cross country meet is you have to get there. So you're going to drive there, right? Usually, or take a train or whatever. But there's a real camaraderie, real team. Element to it. Sort of going back to how we first fell in love with the sport, how I first fell in love with the sport. I did cross country in high school and in college throughout. I did only a little bit of track, and then I've done road races and marathons as a grown up. But it was cross country that drew me into running, and partly because I love running in the fall. It's the most pleasant season to run in. And so doing marathons now for me, it's sort of like the culmination of a cross country season in high school was that mm-hmm. it's sort of the time of year where I enjoy peaking the most. And this was quite late in the year for cross country. I'd never run a cross country race in December before, mm-hmm. but running outside, like passing people when you're running through the woods, or we didn't run through the woods this time, but on the open field, there's something about it that's just a bit more liberating than on a track. It's clearly less time focused. It's more competition focused. But one other thing about a race, which I'm not sure we mentioned on the show before, but when you start a cross country race, you know, when you start a road race, there's maybe 10 or 20 people across, and then you got this long procession going through the start line at the beginning. In a cross country race, it's pretty much people are lined up hundreds across in a row, and then the gun goes off, and it's like Braveheart or something. I mean, everyone's just sprinting, madly sprinting, and there's something primal about it. It's this huge herd. This huge herd is galloping at the beginning. And yeah, you're kind of competing with people, but you're also in this big, colossal wave of energy. And in our sense, in our case, it was this sort of middle-aged man energy. You know, it's sort of it was very bonding in a way because we're all just out there having an experience. And there was some, I know there was one on our track club, there was a baby that needed to be looked after for a bit or babysat for a bit. And I was thinking of my kids and their play dates. And someone mentioned this is like just a big grown up play date.
That's right.
And that's what it was. It's just like all of these adults who were so healthy, all right, to be able to run these races so fast. I mean, in physically at least, you know, very healthy adults, all like having this big group experience. And it's just fine if you finish 299th out of 444 because it's a tough field. And it was just a lot of fun. And there's a lot of team camaraderie and like you know, it's not, this isn't why we do it, but it's sort of nice to know that there are a whole bunch of Instagram moments. Like there are a bunch of people taking pictures. If you're on one of these track clubs that has photographers, and Central Park Track Club has amazing photographers. So you get to sort of relive your heroism a little bit later, right?
Yeah, that's so well said, Bren. There's so many magical parts to it. The way the start works in cross country, just being on grass, the way the fans are just, you know, a constant presence mm-hmm. throughout, and how we as spectators could watch the open men and open women, not only very, very close to the action where they're whizzing by just a few feet from us, but we can see them many times by running to another spot. So you can be a runner and a spectator at the same time. It's just very, very cool. I have two little anecdotes from my race, which was behind you, but just points out some of the fun that everyone's having. Not long after the start, we were probably less than maybe a half mile in, and someone screams to one of the runners that was near us, "Come on, Scott. Let's go, Scott." And for some reason, several of us, five or six different runners around Scott, just kept saying, "Come on, Scott. Let's go, Scott." So that was kind of fun. But later in the race, when things were getting really kind of difficult, you mentioned the white lines.
Yeah.
Well, we were coming through, and you know, back where I was, it was getting a bit sparse, and there was a field marshal that was saying, "Respect the lines," because we were doing exactly as you were saying. We were trying to find the green, which means like sometimes going maybe a little across that little white line.
Right.
And I think someone maybe right behind me or right around me said, "There's no cheating in this part of the race," or like this, you know, this far back. Like, who are you kidding? We're not cutting the corners to finish 358th. So it was just very cool. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Just a great, great day out there. Mm-hmm. And an amazing sport. Now, one thing I wanted to get at that Schwartz was talking about in your interview, you know, he was saying, and I completely agree with him that, you know, there should be more of these events. Like, you know, it seems like a place where the sport could grow. One thing, he mentioned TV, and I'm not certain that it's necessarily a TV audience where the potential is. I mean, maybe, mm-hmm. but for me, it's more about the participation, because the positive energy among all the participants there, and I mean, it drew in a lot of people. I think that the participation at this event was higher than it ever had been at the club cross country across all the fields. Mm-hmm. It seems like something that could definitely grow, sort of post-collegiate cross-country running. Mm-hmm. You know, I know that park runs are a huge thing in England, especially, but, you know, I don't know how much overlap there is, but there's just something about running in the fields as opposed to the sanctioned road race, mm-hmm. you know, or the organized road race that is really taps into a very positive, kind of friendly vibe.
Yep.
And it's not, you know, it's not as extreme as the ultras. And I know the ultras have become more popular, and nothing against the ultras, but, you know, cross country, a shorter cross country race, has a lot to be said for it, as a participatory event. And one where maybe, you know, the number of marathon finishers or 10K finishers or half marathon finishers, that's been tracked over a long period of time. I'm curious what the trends are on the number of cross-country race finishers and you know, what the possibilities are there.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you know, cross-country is very big in England, bigger than it is in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And there are these a lot more events. There are more, like each county will have a series of races culminating in the county championships, which then leads to the Southern Nationals and the Northern Nationals culminating in the Nationals. And the fields might be even deeper, because I think cross country is just an even bigger part of the culture. And somehow the fields are even muddier because there's more rain. And I think they love that. I think the Brits, they're a muddy people by nature. So as Coach Schwartz says, I don't see why there's not more of it here. But also I disagree with you. I think it could be a TV event, or the equivalent of TV, let's say streaming.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Picture a couple of extra ingredients. If you had, as we've talked about before with other running events, if you had better stats, if you had data on there, and mm-hmm. then team data, because we saw from the NCAA champs, like there can be swings where one team is gaining on another. I mean, the Tin Men might not have been in such a great position a quarter of the way into the race, but we could have seen how dominant they got as the race progressed. But how about drones, Bren? How about some drones following around the runners with some beautiful aerial shots? It doesn't take a whole lot of investment, but he put a couple of those elements together. I think he could make a compelling race. And of course, if you add the top runners, who we'll see more of them in January in San Diego, the U.S. cross-country championships, not the club, but the individual cross-country championships will be January in Balboa Park in San Diego. It may not be quite like last year because there's no World Cross, but USA Cross will be interesting, and we'll see some famous runners. I don't know. I think it could be a much more popular sport. I mean, people watch horse racing, and that's horses on mud. Why not humans on mud?
Well, let's keep doing those kinds of races. But before we sort of dedicate ourselves wholeheartedly to cross country, I know, Greg, you still have about 46 more marathons to run, including the next one that you've lined up. You want to tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, well, we've been telling ourselves that we definitely want to cover the U.S. marathon trials, February 29th, Leap Day in Atlanta. And I noticed that the day after that, that's on a Saturday, the next day, March 1st, the Atlanta Track Club is also putting on the Atlanta Marathon and a half marathon and I think a 10K, or at least three different races. But I'm fixing to run that marathon the day after we cover the trials. Why not make it a great, great weekend of running? And I encourage anybody who's into that, either one or both, the trials and the marathon the next day, to come join us in Atlanta. We'll have a party. Are you in, Bren?
No. I'm in for covering it, yes. That sounds awesome.
So you're going to cover the marathon and hand me some water the next day.
I will cover the marathon. I will hand you some water or throw some wet washcloths at you or whatever it is you need.
Okay.
You know, thanks. It's going to be it's Atlanta. I guess it won't be that hot at that time of year, but whatever you need, Greg.
I think the trials is on a notoriously hilly course, a three-loop course. The next day, the Atlanta Marathon is undulating, very, very undulating. I don't think there's a whole lot of flat in Atlanta, but I'm looking forward to it.
That's exciting. That's great. Now, Greg, tell me, how is your high mileage, high volume training plan going?
It's going. It's not quite up to the peaks, but it's getting there. I've had a 50-mile week, headed for another 50-mile week. That's not uncharted territory for me, but maybe it is this time of year. It's hard, Bren. It's hard when it's cold and it's howling. And you and I ran during a snow squall the other day. So thanks to you for joining me for some runs right after work. I'm hoping to climb up and, as Nate said, not skip a decade. So hopefully in the 60s next week. Actually, I had this thought that the holidays are often seen as a time where it's hard to run because you have so many family events and so much eating. But actually, you do have time off. And if you don't have time off, I find work can start to quiet down. Maybe not this week, but next week, the following. There is some quiet time where you can do those extended lunch runs, maybe sneak in a 10-mile lunch run. I've done that in the past. I think there is room to find some running spots during the holidays. What do you think?
You're right. I know. I like that mindset because it is very easy. See, it's very easy to not to use the holidays as a excuse to rest. There are a lot of built-in excuses, but I like the way you're looking at that. You're sort of flipping it on its head. You're like, actually, this is you can use it as see the free time in the day and make use of it. And work does calm down for a lot of people. So I like it, Greg. No, I'm impressed. As we mentioned on the run, you doing your 50-mile weeks is helping me do my 8-mile weeks as opposed to 0-mile weeks. So, but I can tell that you're looking for every opportunity to run, and I think that's you're in the groove. I'm impressed at how you've stayed there, and you seem to be in the base camp stage of your sort of high mileage plan.
Yeah, I'm not worrying at all about pace. I'm running pretty slow, actually. Not slow, creaky slow, but pretty slow. And I'm hoping that as I continue to have a lot of miles, that I'll just speed up without even trying to, just by getting more fit.
Did you feel it in the cross-country race, though? Did you feel like that the fitness translated late in the race, or
Not really. No, I didn't feel particularly fit. If it was okay, but it was just, I felt like I didn't have a lot of strength. And on the uphills, I felt particularly weak. They were not steep uphills, as we mentioned on the show. They were kind of extended gradual hills, but man, I felt like I was crawling. I felt like I had no leg strength. It wasn't, maybe it was partly cardio, but I just felt like I had no wheels going up those hills at all. But I'm not worried about it. I think I'll, you know, just continue to add on miles. And I think I probably need to do more strength training. As much as Schwartz hates squats and lunges, I think they are important for me because I'm not one of the tin men. There's a lot more slack in my fitness that needs to be addressed.
Yeah, that was an interesting part of the interview. It sounded like you had swallowed something. He swallowed a canary when he said that. And I think that's interesting how it sort of flew in the face of a lot of, I think the way a lot of people see squats, doing squats is sort of.
Well, you know, it just brings to mind, we're not, you know, we do use the elites to help us and we relate a lot of things because a lot of things do translate, but not everything translates.
Right.
He's absolutely right. The guys who run 13:30, the women who run 15-minute 5Ks, they're all strong. They're all fit. They all have a lot of the attributes that some of us mid-packers lack. I think people of our abilities might have one thing we rely on to be pretty good, and maybe we're weaker in other areas. I think I have a very well-developed aerobic capacity, but I don't think I have strength. I'm slow. I'm terrible on hills, and I'm terrible on mud. So that tells me that's a weakness that I need to work on. Slow meaning no sprinting, no explosiveness. I can't jump over a piece of toast. But you put me on some flat ground, Brad. You put me on some flat ground with some vapor flies, I'm okay.
All right. Well, that's our ode to cross country.
Yes.
So, and you're on your training plan. Greg, let's finish up. I just want to finish up with one holiday thought here.
Okay.
I'm going to indulge my family here, but I have a nephew named Nicholas who does ballet, and he was quoted in a Vancouver magazine. He's 15 years old, and I really was impressed by this quote, and I thought, you know, he's talking about more than just ballet here. So for runners, and, you know, you can apply it to running, and I'll talk a bit about how I think of it in terms of cross country. But you could apply it to life in general, too. So here's the quote. He said, "I won't lie. It's a lot of pressure, but it's also really great feeling. A big part of dancing and what changes dance from a sport to an art is the ability to perform. I try every show to just focus on the audience because you have to have faith in your training to a certain point. You just have to let it all go on stage and really perform. Because it's not about you. It's about everybody else and about telling the story." So again, that was my nephew Nicholas about performing ballet in the Nutcracker. But I really loved it because, first of all, for a teenager to mention that it's not all about you seems unusual. Yeah. I think it takes people lifetimes to realize that. But also the essence of what he's talking about in the dance. And I think that that applies, and mind you, my nephew's very good at dance. He's much better at it than I am at running. But I think that it applies to any athlete who gets in the moment in the race, no matter how good or how relatively bad you think you are compared to others or whatever. I mean, it's just like if you are getting into it and you focus on the audience and you realize that it's basically a performance. You're performing. You are on the stage. And that, I think, was what I really loved about that cross country, Greg. It, you know, the New York City Marathon, I always feel like an Olympian being cheered by so many people. You get that? Mm-hmm. But you get that in cross country. And it's not even necessarily from the audience. It's from just the performance itself. And it doesn't matter if you're fast or if you're slow. You are performing. You're part of this wave of energy. And everybody out there who's headed to the finish line is performing. So I just thought that was really nice. So I you know, thank you to my nephew Nicholas for that wonderful quote. I really I mean, I'm biased. He's my nephew, but
you're not biased. That's a great quote. It's wonderful. It's great. It's letting all of the hard work and taking all the hard work and putting it on display.
Yeah.
And it should be the fun part, as Desi Linden and others say. It should be where it just flows.
Yeah, it should be the fun part. And I think that's we preach that a lot on this show. But the race is really it's the gift. And, you know, the training, you know, part of what was so impressive about the Tin Men and the guy who ran sub 30 and those conditions is you see that gift and you think, wow, that's incredible. And he worked so hard to do that. And you don't see, no one is cheering for all that hard work when it's happening on the days that are not the race days. But on the race day, everyone can see it and it's a gift.
Mm-hmm. One last thought. If it's a gift, check out Gene Dykes on Facebook. He, this time of year, he plans out his race calendar for the following year. He's got a lot of gifts planned for 2020. He's got a lot of gifts every week. He's got
under that tree,
man. He's the, we've had him on twice. He's the 71-year-old, Marvel who, and I think he's running something like 8 marathons and a bunch of 50 milers and 100 milers and 1500 meter races and just cross country all over the place.
He was there. He was there.
He just loves it. He's just, he treats it like a treat. That's what they are, these races. So,
yeah.
And that's part of why I picked Atlanta, because I didn't have, you asked me right after Cross. He said, what's right. next up for you? And I was like, I don't know. And that directly led me to looking and signing up for Atlanta.
All right. Onwards to Atlanta.
Onwards.
Well, for Greg Lemostein, this is Brent Jones. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a wonderful, wonderful holidays, and we'll see you in 2020. See you next time on Cloud 259.
Went home this morning, the clock was striking four. Went home this morning, the clock was striking four. And I seen another daddy going out my back door. I'm Atlanta bound, Atlanta bound. I'll hunt that rounder that stole that gal of mine. I'm Atlanta bound, Atlanta bound. I'll bring him back in a box of pine. Do-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de-de